The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is part two on all things Felton Road. For people who don't know, I think I did a bad job introducing it last time. Felton Road, a classic winery in central Otago, South Island, New Zealand, making just incredible Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Riesling. A lot of absolutely stunning single vineyard stuff. Their prices are remarkable. And as I said before, go and you can find them at restaurants all across Toronto. I'm giving another shout out to Blue Bovine Steak and Sushi House. They've got a happy hour from 3 to 6 p.m. You can get a good bottle of Felton Road for half off. You're not doing better than that. And joining me now, the man responsible for that bottle of Felton Road, it is the winemaker, Blair Walter. Blair, thank you so much for being on the pod today.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's start here. How rare in the wine world, and maybe more so in the new wine world, France and Germany, it's passed down winemakers from generation to generation and no one leaves, but you've been there right from the start. You have been with, you've been there before Nigel Green, and you've been with Felton Road from the very beginning, mid to late 90s. How rare is that in the new wine world to have that sort of stability?
You do see it about, but I guess it is relatively uncommon. And I think the big difference for us is that when I first started with Felton Road back in 1996, I was invited into the business as to become a small shareholder. So that's, absolutely, critical and key to, retaining people, but also, changes the whole dynamic and the emphasis of your position within the company and the way that you go about your work.
That makes sense. I didn't even think about that. So for you, right from the start, you had a sense of ownership. It wasn't just about making wine, but the soil, the bricks and mortar, you have a much closer identity with that, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I was involved, designing the winery. I was also involved with not the label design. Stuart already had that done. The brand presentation, brand design, what we were going to be about, how we presented ourselves. So I've been involved, right from the very beginning. And, as you mentioned, prior to Nigel coming along.
What were those early years like? What was 1995, around that time period, 96? What was that like for Blair Walter?
Funny you mention 1995, because I often tell people that New Zealand wine was very, very different back then. It was only 1995 when Müller Thurgau was surpassed as our most planted variety. So a lot of people don't realize that. Back in 1990, we only had 6,000 hectares of vines. Now we have 42,000. We only had 100 wineries. Now we have over 700. So the industry, when I joined it in the early 90s, was much different. And I feel very privileged to have been part of that, growing up of New Zealand wine, changing from being Müller Thurgau dominant, a lot of bulk wine, a lot of less expensive wine into the, more premium wines that, you see coming out of New Zealand today.
That is remarkable. I knew there was a lot of source of bulk wine. I forgot about all the Müller Thurgau. What do you think changed? And now we'll go off topic, but we'll get back to Felton Road and your journey. But I'm just fascinated by this from the New Zealand, because the crazy thing about New Zealand is you are in the furthest corner for so many parts of the rest of the world. And yet New Zealand wine is everywhere. I can go into a small town in Ontario, population 10,000, and there'll at least be some Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc there. So I'm wondering, what do you think just changed with New Zealand? God, this is such a hard question to answer, but some of the reasons why things changed over the years from what it was to what it is.
I think our climate in New Zealand is really special and gives us the opportunity to create, vibrant, fruit forward, very drinkable styles of, in the early days, the white wines, of course, dominated by Sauvignon Blanc, as you mentioned. And then increasingly so for, other premium varieties like Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, that our climate, our combination of soils enabled us to make these Really delicious, really fruit forward wines that had, good vibrancy, a good acidity and a freshness that were different from a lot of the dominant exported wines that were found around the world. And if I take our neighbors, Australia, coming from much warmer climates and softer acidities, so riper, more posh styles, whereas New Zealand styles had an acidity and an intensity and a vibrancy to them and captured people's attention. So I think that's one of the very unique things. And then also the New Zealand industry, we're very innovative and very agile and very quick to move. And so from having had, Mula Turgau's our most planted variety, through the 80s into the early 90s, and then being able to quickly change that to more premium varieties and not sort of be hung up on, this is what we've always done and the tradition things, and to have that agility to move with the times.
It's funny because a lot of times having the old tradition is great, where, France or Italy or Spain, you've got the older vines and you've got 500 years of wisdom and monks making champagne a billion years ago, and there's absolutely so many advantages to that. But then it's interesting on your side, not having the burden of history. Also, because of where you're located, you're forced to be more ingenious. You're forced to have to think on your feet and improvise because it's not like you have 12 countries that you can get to by train in terms of wine infrastructure. You guys almost have to figure it out on your own.
Well, I mean, that's sometimes it's a little bit of a curse, and makes it more challenging. But I think we as New Zealanders looked at it as a blessing, and really took it by the horns and ran with it. And so I mean, with other countries, in particular Australia, we had the advent of the flying winemaker with young New Zealand winemakers, Australian winemakers heading to Europe, learning the craft, but also influencing and modernizing sort of traditional and poor quality wines out of Europe, for the low cost wines. And sort of bringing those sorts of ideas back to New Zealand and thinking about, how we could offer sort of mid-priced to low-priced wines with a vibrancy and an intensity that, Europe was probably struggling with at that time. Things have changed now. Not having that history and not being able to ask your father or your grandfather of, how do I deal with this particular issue, or it was perhaps a challenge. But it, as I said earlier, having that agility and being able to work quickly and develop new ideas and not be sort of caught up in a culture and a tradition has been a real blessing.
What was your vision for Felton Road, or even just for that particular plot of land in Central Otago? As you said, Blair, when you got there early on, New Zealand was still making that switch from bulk wine and little used grapes you find in corners of Germany among hipster winemakers. What was your vision of that land?
I guess you had to have some optimism and have a feeling that these wines could be interesting. We had some examples from the mid 80s, late 80s, with the first high quality Pinot Noirs coming out of the Martinborough area in the lower part of the North Island. There was some good Pinot Noirs coming out of Canterbury, but Central Otago's first commercial wine was not only 1987, and they were made in tiny quantities up until the mid 90s from when we came along. And so there To think of the wines as having international credibility and the opportunity to sell all over the world was, not immediately apparent. We seem to have had timing on our side and rode a really nice wave of interest from around the world in the quality and the style of Pinot Noirs that were coming out of New Zealand, and we just happened to capitalize on that. One of the things that we felt early on was the interest that we were receiving, that we would support that and, make allocations available to all of the markets that were, pursuing us. And, it's been really incredible for our brand ever since, to have that global recognition and global distribution.
How much of a point of pride is it for you when you're traveling? Because the funny thing is, as a winemaker, you spend a lot of time traveling all around the world. How much of a point of pride is it for you when you go to a famous restaurant, a Michelin star restaurant, and you see not just Felton Road wines, but plenty of other, say, Central Otago wines on wine lists at famed restaurants?
Oh, it's incredible. I have this line that I use when I'm in, great cities of all around the world, whether it's, Toronto or Taipei or, Dubai, and you're sitting in a restaurant that might be on the, 60th or the 94th floor, and you're looking out over a city, and I'll see, more people and, than what I'll see in New Zealand. I'll see more people in one day than what I'll see in New Zealand in the next 12 months. And you're in these incredible big cities, incredible restaurants, and to have this little winery from, Bannockburn, Central Otago, and, our other colleagues' wines from elsewhere in Central and New Zealand, being listed. It's immensely satisfying. And in
Oh.
such a short space of time, too.
Oh,
It happened very quickly for us.
yeah, 30 years goes fast, and yet the difference is incredible. I can tell you one of the top-rated restaurants in Toronto, Don Alfonso. I just thought of it because you mentioned up on the top floor. One of the somms let me know, "Hey Matt, the new Felton Road Chardonnay is in." So, your wines are poured there. But let's go back to the 90s. How important is Stewart Elms? Because Nigel mentioned his name a bunch of times. How important is Stewart Elms to the story, not only of the winery, but to your wine story as well?
Stuart is very critical. I met him back in 1990 when I was finishing my university studies, and Stuart was the attending Lincoln University to do a postgraduate diploma in viticulture and enology as a mature student. He was 55 years old. I was the youngest in the class. I was still 20, and we got paired up as wine chemistry lab partners. I used to write up my lab reports, and Stuart would always ask me, how did I do this? How did I do that? He had never done university chemistry before. And I would give him a hand. And in the end, I would just write up my reports and give them to Stuart. And he would take them home. And I said, look, just don't get us in trouble and hand them in on time. And that went on throughout the year. Little did I know that 4 years later, I had a dinner with him. I was about to go off to Napa Valley for a winemaking job over there for a couple of years. And he showed me photographs of a vineyard that he had been planting in Bannockburn in Central Otago. I'd never ever heard of Bannockburn before. And he said, look, I might be looking for a winemaker in a couple of years. Stay in touch. And so we wrote each other letters over the couple of years, and they got more and more serious. And that's when he invited me to get involved right from the beginning, and also financially. Stuart's background in viticulture, sorry, in wine was, quite remarkable, having come from the hotel business and working in fine wine, having a fine dining restaurant, being a wine merchant. This was from the 1960s and 70s. So he knew what great wine was about. And he also, after selling the hotel in the late 70s, he became a farmer, farming black currants amongst sheep and cattle. So having that connection to the land and understanding of what it means to be a farmer, but then with the incredible combination of understanding what great wine was about from having dealing with first growth Bordeaux's, being a wine merchant, was really a deadly combination.
What a crazy story, just about
What
the laws of unintended consequences. You sitting in the class and you're sitting next to Stuart. I mean, your first day, I remember when I was in university, when I was a 20-year-old fool, and I'd see the older students, I'm like, "Oh, what the hell are you doing here? You're going to ask the teacher more questions when we want to leave class as fast as we can." I mean, just what a wild story about pairing up with Stuart and where that led to.
Yeah, it was quite extremely fortuitous. I mean, just this Friday, I've got a dinner for a friend's 60th. He was in the wine class, so there's going to be four of us that were classmates in that class. I mean, sadly, Stuart passed away a couple of years ago, but those classmates that I'm meeting up with on Friday night, they came to Stuart's memorial, where I was asked to speak and talk about Stuart's wine life, which I was, very, very honored to do in front of his, all his family and friends. But yeah, we'll be. Stuart kindly left me a dozen bottles for me to select from his cellar in his will, and so I'll be taking another one of those bottles to be drinking on Friday night, and we'll be raising a glass to Stuart.
What will that bottle be? Do you know? Have you decided yet?
last year, with the same group of friends, we drank a 53 Petrus and a 1937 Chateau Orson. So I'm wondering whether it's time for the 59 Oberon or the 1921 Oberon. He left me some pretty special bottles. So and I intend to open them and drink them and toast to Stuart. And particularly when I can do it with my classmates to remember back to the 1990 when we all met. It's pretty special.
I mean, that kind of right there, that's sort of the ultimate definition of why we drink wine, why we seek it out is A, you're going to drink something historic that was made by by incredible people in history. You're going to be, opening wine that was made when soon after the Second World War. And so you're going to have the whole wine side to it, but then the emotional side and toasting it. I imagine every emotion is going to be engaged, probably some people crying or at least choking up a little bit, either tears of joy, of sadness, and also wonderment of the wine. I mean, that right there, Blair, I can't think of a better example of why we drink wine.
That's when I was phoned by Stuart's daughter to advise me that there was something in his will and he had left these bottles for me to act. I got to select the 12 bottles and I advised the family on what to do with the remaining bottles was Stuart's request. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're not just trophy items that you should have in your cellar and sort of think that these are worth thousands and thousands of dollars. They're there for enjoyment and for sharing. And I'm the recipient of lots of other really amazing bottles from generous people that invite me to tastings or to dinners at their house and open incredible bottles. So it's really nice to be able to do the same when you have the opportunity.
Absolutely. And for people listening, try your best. I know it's hard. Don't treat wine as a trophy. Treat it as the centerpiece of a great night. Even a beautiful first growth Bordeaux, if you got a lot of them, open one on a Tuesday. Just make that Tuesday that much more special. We'll now switch and get a little bit wine nerdy. What do people need to know about Bannockburn? What about this appellation? And again, I apologize because you never want to do full generalizations because where the vineyard is located in Bannockburn, it's going to be different and vintages are different. But what do people in general just need to know about this area?
It's the southernmost of New Zealand's regions, central Otago, so it is a cool climate. We're inland and protected by the mountains, so there is an element of continentality. We call it a semi-continental climate, but we're still only 117 kilometers from the ocean to the west, east, and south. A lot of people, when they come to central Otago, and from a Canadian perspective, this is interesting. They say it reminds them of the Okanagan, being a dry mountainous area with a lot of lakes. So it's a dry climate, not nearly as cold as the Okanagan, but we do record the coldest winters of anywhere in New Zealand. And then we also record the warmest summertime temperatures because we're inland and away from the ocean. So again, sort of giving it that sort of Okanagan-like climate. It's very remote. We have a resort town, Queenstown, which is 1 hour west of us, and Queenstown just got a traffic light just a few years ago. Otherwise, it was a 3 hour drive to see a traffic light. That was always an amusing thing to share with people when I was in big cities around the world. And it's very rural, lots of orchards. Cherries are a really big crop in central Otago, along with the grapes. And then there's just high country sheep farms with merino sheep. It's a
If I go,
beautiful place.
I can't wait to come. We're going to be there in March. When I think of continental climate, if I go back to WSET level one, just your very basic general thing, when I think continental, I think more thicker skin grapes and more robust wines. What is it about your area that does so well for Chardonnay and for Pinot? And of course, Riesling. Can't forget Riesling. But just what is it about your area that works so well for those, for the Burgundian varietals?
I think the dry climate, so we have very low rainfall, low humidity, so disease pressure is extremely low for us, and so we're not hit by that. A lot of areas where people go to grow Pinot Noir and try to find these cool climates can also become wet climates, and particularly in the autumn when you get the threat of autumn rains, causing dilution and disease issue at harvest. So we don't have to contend with that. And then the other significant thing about our climate is the diurnal variation that we have. So we have warm days and then very cold nights. So that locks in the acidity, seals in the varietal freshness, giving a good vibrancy to the wine. So yeah, I would say that climate is pretty special.
In terms of making wine, do you have any non-negotiables? Things you will either not do, or these are things we are always going to do before we put that wine, before we put that juice in a bottle.
I've been fortunate that, we've always been 100% estate grown. I've never had to purchase grapes, or make wine from purchased grapes. So they've always been from our viticulture. And so if we have a great vineyard site and then have, incredible farming, to the best of our ability, that, we're always learning and always getting better. But my role then as a winemaker is just carefully guiding the fruit to the bottle. So having, high quality grapes that you've been intimately involved with right from the, the pruning, the beginning of the growing season, is absolutely critical to me. I don't think I could make wine from, purchased grapes and trying to express that. That would be winemaking. Whereas, my role is winemaker, but I really struggle with that because we're more of a just a caretaker or just guiding the fruit to the bottle when you have such great raw materials.
You never, never admit that. Never admit that. These bottles, these single vineyard bottles, is because of the work that Blair has done. No, I mean, it was actually a conversation I had with Nigel talking about how you guys early on were about we're going to focus on the fact that this isn't the winemaker's name. This wine comes from this very specific plot of land. So for you guys, it was important that people knew the site specificness of the wines that they were drinking.
Absolutely. That's been a key, not so much point of difference, but a key feature of our brand right from the beginning is coming out with single vineyard bottlings. Initially, the first vintage we bottled Block 3 as a single vineyard wine and introduced Block 5 2 years later. And now, we have six different bottlings of Pinot Noir.
Going back to that, yeah, I mean, that's so much more normal now. It's even normal here in Niagara. It's just the norm. I wish I could find a different word than normal, but we'll just carry on. How, when you guys first started doing that, how many other wineries were inclined, to follow suit?
In New Zealand at the time, there were only just a couple of examples of single vineyard bottlings being done. At that time, if you were going to be doing something special, it was usually called, barrel selection or reserve or family reserve or these sorts of names. I'd come back from, a couple of years in California, the Napa Valley, and saw a lot of the single vineyard bottlings in different parts of California and also a lot up in Oregon, but also just I did a vintage in Burgundy, and I was always enamored with single vineyards, all the different villages and classification of Premier Cru and Grand Cru vineyards. And so I felt that if we had an opportunity to make some special wines in Central Otago, that following that lead and having the vineyards take the the key spot of presentation and the wine, and being able to our customers being able to follow those vineyards from year to year, I thought was going to be the most interesting path for us to follow.
How important is it for you as a winemaker or a custodian, whatever term you want to use, to be drinking other people's wines?
Oh, absolutely. I just before we got on this call, I just answered an offer to some Burgundy that, while it's starting to get out of my price range, I just thought, I need to keep up to date with some of these wines. So absolutely, we're always drinking other wines, and very rarely do I open a bottle of Felton Road at home. It's usually the night after bottling. that I, want to share with my partner, or just think about the, all the hard work that went in over the last sort of 18 months to get that wine to the bottle. And I just, it's just, even though it was just bottled that day, there's a really nice sense of satisfaction of opening it up and just looking at the wine and seeing it as a fresh young bottle. And then the only other time we drink our own wine at home or at the winery is when we're entertaining guests and, we need to be seen to be showing our wine. Otherwise, there's all sorts of things being opened here.
Yeah, it would be weird if you were doing a Felton Road wine event and, you were opening all Oregon or, Sonoma Pinot. That would be strange. People wonder, hey, where's your wine? What are any major differences that stand out for you about making wine in different parts of the world? You mentioned Napa and Oregon and Burgundy, and obviously you've been making wine in Central Otago for 30 years. Is there anything that sticks out for you about the major differences in other parts of the world?
Yeah, I think it's about context. And when I worked in, say, let's take Napa as the example. Those wines were drank at that particular time where I was working. I would say they were 98 to 99% consumed in the USA. And so you're making wines for an American market, for that palate, for that for the reviewers, the critical acclaim that they were getting. And so the style has to be consistent with the context of which it's going to be consumed in. And I think that's one of the benefits that we have coming from New Zealand and a smaller state like ours, that focusing on quality wines, is that the New Zealand market gets too small for us very, very quickly. And so we're forced to look internationally for our markets and for sales, and we're fortunate that we have a quality that is of interest, and therefore that then becomes self-perpetuating, that you're on a not a treadmill, but you're on this road that you have to live up. It has to be internationally relevant for the wines to continue selling, because you're up against a global marketplace. And so that's been really, really critical for us, and influencing the style of wines. So yeah, at making wines, relative to the context that they're going to be consumed in, I think is important.
So going to your wines now. We're almost done this interview. We haven't actually talked about the Felton portfolio. I forget the number. I think it's like five or six different Pinot, four or five Chardonnay, and one Riesling. My numbers are probably off a little bit, but I'm wondering what the difference in your Pinots are depending on the vineyard. Like, what do people can expect if it's Block 3 versus Bannockburn versus Calvert?
Yeah, so let's start with the Bannockburn. So that's our sub-region where we're located. Bannockburn has about 350 hectares of vines in total, and we own 34 of those across four different vineyards. And so our Bannockburn blend is essentially like a village bottling of our four vineyards. But the difference when we use the word village, in Burgundy, those are being classified as being of lesser quality, is not as interesting as, say, the Premier Cru or Grand Cru sites. Whereas we have four very, very good sites in Bannockburn that come together to make our Bannockburn vineyard. And the Bannockburn bottling has exact same viticulture, exact same winemaking as the single vineyard wines like MacMuir, Cornish Point, Calvert, Block 3, Block 5. It's just that it's a blended wine. And then when you get to, say, the single vineyard wines, say Block 3 or Block 5, they're from the Elms Vineyard, from our oldest vines. So you've got now 32, 33-year-old vines. And so you're getting added complexity and harmony and balance from having that greater vine age. And that's something that we're enjoying, of course, every year as the vines are getting older, is benefiting from those aging vineyards.
Now, what about on the Chardonnay side of things? I'll word the question a little bit different, Blair. What is a good glass of Felton Road Chardonnay? What should it taste like?
First and foremost, it should taste of Bannockburn, Central Otago. And for a lot of people, that might be unfamiliar, but that's okay, so long as the unfamiliar is interesting and intriguing, and balanced, salivating. So for us, it's the acidity is one of the defining features of our style of Chardonnay. And also the opportunity to have this, along with the acidity coming from a cool climate, is a minerality or a sense of saline, salty, mineral character. And we get a lot of that from the schist soils that we're growing in. And also the cool climate is making the wines not so heavy, not so fruit forward, and not so ripe. And so they are going to have a lot more tension and detail and finesse about them. So they're not very heavily fruited. They're very delicately oaked. In fact, we virtually use no new oak, just replacement barrels only. And so they're quite subtle. So a lot of people say they're more European in style than, say, typical New World style of Chardonnay.
So if someone's blinding them, they'd probably go more Montrachet than Sonoma.
Yeah, that's a fairly big call, Montrachet. I'd say we're a bit more subtle. We're probably more Chablis-like, or
Right.
maybe more Mâcon-like. You know, more. Well, I'd say Chablis. You know, they're a little bit racier, a little bit steelier, and not heavily oaked and not so full-bodied. So.
Should Pinot Noir be consumed with fish? I saw in an interview talking about this. People just think it should be white with fish all the time. We only have a couple of minutes, so I figured do a fun question or two. Would you recommend Pinot Noir with fish?
Well, of all the red varieties, I think Pinot Noir is would be the most suitable for matching with fish. And then it's all about just getting the accompaniment right with the fish dish. So not having a butter sauce or a lemon butter sauce with it, the fish. You do need to sort of think about, you know, the Pinot Noir flavors. But I've seen very, very successful matches with, you know, including eggplant, aubergine, lentils, miso. Works really, really well. Mushroom, anything that just brings a sort of a slightly earthier element to the fish dish. And then I think you've got an incredible match and something that really surprises people because, like you said, it's not something that people first think of. You know, when I'm doing a wine dinner and I'm getting I'm asked by the chef to help create some this is the menu or some ideas for the matching and the pairings, I'll always suggest fish because I think it's so fun and it really opens people's eyes.
I know it was a year ago. How was that 53 Petrus?
It was on form. Like we were, I was, you know, I was thinking that, you know, it could be disappointing. We might just be sitting there and going, ah, oh, this is a, you know, 70-year-old wine that's, you know, probably should have been drunk, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But we were all flabbergasted. It was absolutely delicious. And I'm lucky I've got another bottle in the cellar too. So I'm going to be able to see it a second time.
That's fantastic. Listen, Blair, really appreciate you doing this. The story of, I mean, it's funny, the story of Felton Road is kind of the story of friendship of you and Stuart and you and Nigel and you and Nigel continuing for 30, close to 30 years. I mean, that kind of is the story of Felton Road. It's a wonderful story. I love the philosophy behind your wines in terms of winemaking, pricing, and just your general overall belief of how wine should be consumed. So I really appreciate you taking the time to do the pod, and I hope to be able to see you in person sometime in March.
I really look, yeah, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, really look forward to receiving you in March. That's a really nice time to visit. If it's late March, we could be harvesting, but early mid-March, we'll have time on our hands to receive you well. It's a beautiful time just pre-harvest to see the, you know, the fruit hanging on the vine, just ready, getting ready for harvest. So look forward to it.
I hope traffic isn't bad with the one traffic light. Thank you, Blair.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.